Hey everyone, what's going on? Welcome to a brand new edition of the Sam Bissell Podcast on the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions. And right now, I'm going to be bringing you the latest and greatest going on around the world of Hollywood. Hope everyone is having a wonderful week so far, ready for the July 4th weekend ahead and for the rest of the summer. Today, I'm going to be talking about a bunch of stuff and kind of recapping a lot of big events that happened around the world of Hollywood this week. I'm going to be getting into the major casting news that went on this week. Of course, probably the biggest casting news we'll probably get probably in 2023 when it comes to casting the brand new Superman and Lois Lane for the new DCU era that is being shepherded in by James Gunn and Peter Safran. I'm also going to be getting into kind of the initial projections that are happening right now for what I consider to be the biggest box office matchup probably of the decade, maybe the century, probably over-exaggerating there, and of course Barbie and Oppenheimer on July 21st. So we'll get into that a little bit later. Also get into the weekend preview, kind of give you insights into what's coming out this weekend, both in theaters, and if there's anything also coming out on streaming. We'll get into all that and much more. But the first thing that I do want to talk about on the podcast today is something that usually I kind of bring up when it happens. It's news that I don't like to bring in, of course, and it's sad, unfortunate news in talking about the passing of a true acting legend in Hollywood, as it was announced and reported by all the trades today, earlier in the morning, that legendary actor Alan Arkin passed away at the age of 89. Now, it's not confirmed or reported on whether it was today or yesterday. Usually, sometimes an actor or somebody might pass away and the next day it's reported on, so who knows when the actual timeline of events happened, but the results are the same way. We lost a terrific, incredible, funny performer in Alan Arkin. He was a four-time Oscar-nominated actor, two for Best Actor, two for Best Supporting Actor, won one for Little Miss Sunshine in 2006, was nominated also in Best Supporting Actor in 2012 for his role in the Ben Affleck-directed Oscar-winning Best Picture film, Argo. But you just know Alan Arkin for so much more. And if you're somebody who knew him from the 60s and the 70s, even the 80s and 90s with films such as Edward Scissorhands and Catch 22 in the 70s, he was somebody who was just able to be a great performer. But for me personally, I first caught on to Alan Arkin in films that he was in over the last two decades or so. When you even go back to a film like Get Smart in 2008, that was actually the first film that I ever saw him in when he was playing the role of the cheat. And that was a film that had Steve Carell, Anne Hathaway, Dwayne Johnson. Then he was probably the standout performer in that movie. And he was somebody that was just funny and just brought some great energy to the film. And so that was my first introduction to Alan Arkin. And then of course, I saw him in films like Little Miss Sunshine, where he was just able to kind of blend in, being that kind of a dirty grandpa in a way, but still had heart and soul and care for this little young girl and Abigail Breslin. So he just delivered a great balance of a performance in that movie and very well deserved that Oscar back in 2006, 2007 for that award season. But then seeing him in later films like Grudge Match, well, Sylvester Stallone, Robert De Niro, and a film like Million Dollar Arm with John Hamm, where he's only in it for a little bit, but when he's on screen, he's just magnetic, and he's somebody that you just remember when coming out of a film, that whatever kind of time he has on screen, he just makes it memorable and delivers and gives you some great laughs along the way. So my heart goes out to the friends and family of Alan Arkin, and again, passing away at any age is tough, but he had a great career, spanned multiple decades, made people laugh and cry and really enjoy the roles that he was in. He was just a terrific performer, a terrific person. Whenever I saw him do interviews, just was somebody who seemed like a really, really great guy, and he will be missed on screen, in person. And again, thoughts and prayers go out to the family and friends of the one and only Alan Arkin, who passed away at the age of 89. And now to move on to the other movie news that is going on around the world of Hollywood today. And probably the biggest news, like I said on the top of the show, that happened this week was probably the biggest news story of 2023 so far. And again, it might be overall in terms of big casting news coming out in the overall year, in the finding officially of our brand new Man of Steel and reporter Lois Lane in the roles of Superman and Lois Fort. Superman Legacy, which is officially tapped as the first major DCU film under the new stewardship of James Gunn, Peter Safran. Superman Legacy is going to be directed and written by James Gunn, coming off of his tenure at Marvel for the Guardians films, did the first season of Peacemaker, did the Suicide Squad back in 2021, and now is kind of the creative shepherd of this new universe moving forward. And over the last couple of weeks, we've been hearing about kind of the finalist per se for both Superman, Clark Kent, and Lois Lane. It was people like Nicholas Holt, David Cornenswent, Tom Brittany, and then on the Lois side, it was people like Rachel Brosnahan, Emma McKay, and Phoebe Denver from Bridgerton. And there was a report that came out on Monday from The Hollywood Reporter, and they've been kind of the people really all over this casting process and kind of detailing the finalists. And then over what was the weekend, 2 weeks ago, during the Father's Day weekend, when these test screenings were going on, kind of Hollywood Reporter was able to detail all the different matchups and pairings that happened, both for Clark and for Lois. And then, of course, having both of the three actors going up for the Man of Steel, going into the iconic costume of Superman to see how he is both as Clark and, of course, as the Man of Steel himself. And it seemed like we were coming down to the wire on this, and maybe in any day leading up to the casting that was officially announced over Tuesday and Wednesday would be coming to fruition. And then sure enough, later in the week, it was announced by multiple outlets and confirmed by James Gunn himself that he had finally found his new Man of Steel and Lois Lane for this new era of the DCU, as it's going to be called. And that is going to be David Cornenswent and Rachel Brosnahan as Clark and Superman and Lois Lane. And according to multiple reports, but specifically coming from Jeff Snyder, who's really good at finding some of these scoops and is a writer at Above the Line, he had this to say about what it came down to in terms of Cornenswent and Rachel Brosnahan and the process of what went into this over the last couple of weeks. So this is what Jeff Snyder had to say on Above the Line. Sources say it came down to Brittany and Cornenswent with social media firmly on the latter side. The actor tested for the role wearing Superman's iconic costume, and he was initially paired with rising actress and Margot Robbie lookalike Emma McKay, who appears to have been the runner-up for the role of Lois Lane. Phoebe Denver also made it to the screen test stage, which took place over 2 days during Father's Day weekend. Cornenswent and Brosnahan and their respective teams were notified on Monday night once Warner Brothers Discovery boss David Zaslav signed off on the decision. Gunn and Safran were extremely tight-lipped about their own preferences while soliciting objective opinions from Warner Brothers execs, whose input in such a decision would be valued. So before I really get into my thoughts about what I think about Cornenswent and Rachel Brosnahan taking on these roles and being our new Superman and Lois Lane, I just want to say over these last couple of weeks, it's been really cool and awesome to kind of see this process play out for a big role like this, because I feel like sometimes when it comes to these roles, it feels like anticlimactic, where one trade has kind of all the news for it. But over these last couple of weeks, it's been really great to kind of see a big role be finalized in this kind of a way, and it really hasn't happened in a long time, I feel like, where you have iconic roles that are wanted across the entire industry of Hollywood and seeing who best fits these roles and who's really up for them. And I really feel like the last time something like this truly happened was years ago. I think it was like 2019, maybe 2018, when the Batman was being offered for Matt Reeves's film, when it came down to, funny enough, Nicholas Holt and Robert Pattinson. Robert Pattinson was the one who ended up as Matt Reeves's Caped Crusader. And so I just feel like you don't see a lot of these auditions play out this way. And so it's really cool to kind of get insight into these processes. And so seeing all this was kind of a breath of fresh air and brought some, I think, great energy to an industry right now that doesn't really have a lot of scoops going on, because a writer's strike is happening and there could be an impending Screen Actors Guild strike on the way as well. And we'll get into how that actually kind of resonates with this, I think, casting as well. But to get into my overall thoughts and what I thought about Cornenswent and Rachel Brosnahan getting these roles, I think this is slam dunk casting from the finalists that were mentioned over the last couple of weeks. I think when you look at David Cornenswent, he gives off both Clark Kent vibes and Superman vibes. And I think he reminds me a lot of, obviously he has a look of a Henry Cavill, but I also think that what James Gunn was kind of seeing and what I think I see, and hopefully I'm hoping what audiences see, is that he, I think, can pull this off kind of like how Christopher Reeve did it years ago in the initial Superman films, where you see Clark Kent, but that person can become Superman, and deep down within him, he is Superman. And I think for Cornet Sweat, I think the fact also that James Gunn is keeping on with the legacy of unknowns really taking on the Man of Steel. Christopher Reeve was really an unknown when he took it in the 70s. You look at someone like a Tom Welling when he took it up for Smallville, and you look at somebody like a Henry Cavill when he was in Zack Snyder's films. Nobody really knew who these people were, and then they became household names because of Superman. And that same thing is, I think, going to happen with David Cornenswet, where I've seen some of the TV shows that he's been a part of, from The Politician. The one that really stuck out to me was being one of the main leads in the ensemble cast of Hollywood, which was a Ryan Murphy limited series that came out in 2020. He was also a supporting actor and role in the HBO limited series We Own This City. So he's very much been on the TV side, made some supporting appearances in some movies, but obviously this is going to be the biggest thing he's ever done in his acting life, and it's one of the roles that, again, multiple people have played it, but they're still memorable for what they're able to do. And I'm excited to see what Cornenswet is going to be able to pull off in the Man of Steel role. But he looks the part. I can see him in the costume. And out of the people that were finalists, this was, I think, the best person that would be able to come out on top and deliver in this role. Unfortunately for Nicholas Holt, I love the guy. He's a tremendous actor. I just couldn't see him in this part. I think he's a much more of a Batman persona and a Batman physique. But again, it was up against him and Robert Pattinson, and Pattinson got it over him. I just think that he needs to carve out his own lane. It's just not working for him right now, and I don't know if maybe James Gunn will offer him something down the line, whether that is Batman, or there were reports earlier on in this process that maybe if Holt doesn't get Superman, he could get a backdoor into premiering and appearing in these films and this DCU as Lex Luthor, which I could actually see that being a better role for him than Superman, both physically and just, I think, as an actor. I don't think he gives off those vibes. I think he fits a lot better in that kind of Lex Luthor villainous role, and he's done some really good villainous roles and kind of asshole roles over the last couple years, whether it's with The Menu or The Great. He just delivers on those performances, so I can see him really kind of using that and delivering that energy into Lex in a much better way. But out of all those finalists, and Tom Brittany was very much an unknown like Cornenswet, but just looking at his profile, his appearance, I never really saw anything that he was in, but I just couldn't see. I could maybe see Superman, but I couldn't really see Clark Kent, whereas again with David Cornenswet, I can see both the alter ego in Clark and the man in Superman. So I think that was the best choice for that role, but somehow, some way, they were able to land a bullseye casting in Rachel Brosnahan as Lois Lane. And I know from some reports and some insiders saying that Rachel Brosnahan, the only, I'm using air quotes if you can't see me right now, quote unquote negative potentially, was that she was the oldest out of the finalists in Emma McKay and Phoebe Denver, who are more in their 20s, and Rachel Brosnahan is 32 years old. And if you're looking at the DCU and the fact that this is probably a role that is going to be played over a long period of time, that maybe they would want to go younger for both of these roles. But I think to James Gunn's tuition, he decided to go against that, and he went with, I think, the best performance that you can go for in Rachel Brosnahan, and she fits Lois Lane. When you look at her, to me, it's like looking at a live action version of Lois Lane coming to life and leaping out from the comic pages onto the screen, and I'm really excited to see what she's going to be able to do. And if you've seen her in her role in the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, you can just see that's a Lois Lane. That is somebody who just exudes power and confidence and just is able to stand there ground to just know what to do. And I just think it's tremendous casting. And I also think this is something that people brought up, and I agree with, in the fact that when you look at what Zach did with Henry Cavill and Amy Adams as Lois Lane, giving the kind of more edged actor, someone who is maybe not as experienced in kind of these big roles and these big productions, give them somebody opposite alongside of them who has been in the industry, has been in these kinds of films, is a credentialed performer, and give them that kind of playing power to kind of go alongside of them for this ride. So with Amy Adams, at the time she was a 3-time Academy Award nominated actress. Now she is a 6-time Academy Award nominated actress. So she's somebody who's been around the industry. So she was able, I think, to help Henry Cavill and kind of play off of him in a very good way and help him kind of build up his confidence in these kinds of films and help kind of deliver that raw performance and kind of mold it into something. And I think the same thing is going to happen with Rachel Brosnahan and David Cornenswet. And I think that's what Gunn and the executives saw on the video with these auditions. And I think this is just tremendous casting on both sides. And to me, it's also very exciting to hear that, according to Justin Kroll and Jeff Snyder, that apparently out of every single one of the auditions, both on the men's and on the women's side, it was Rachel Brosnahan that brought the best audition tape out of everybody. So I'm very excited for her to get this opportunity because, again, she's a tremendous actress. She comes from the TV side. She's done some movies, but again, not as well known on movies as she is TV with Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And so to see her star rise now alongside David Cornenswet is going to be great to really kind of see. And I'm excited to see where this goes from here. Now, the big question moving forward is, now that you have your two main leads, how are you going to fill out the rest of the cast? I know there were reports coming out earlier as well that apparently for the shortlist on Lex Luthor, and while it may or may not be Nicholas Holt, apparently James Gunn is also looking at not just one, but both Skarsgård twins and both Alexander and Bill Skarsgård for the role of Lex Luthor. And that's something that I could definitely maybe see. I don't know if I can see both of them bald and delivering that performance. They have the physical staunchiness, I think, to play Lex Luthor. And I think after seeing Alexander Skarsgård on Succession playing the role that he played, I think he can definitely deliver on giving a performance of kind of a techie version of Lex Luthor in the 21st century. I think he can definitely kind of pull that off. But I wonder if there may be somebody else out there that is could be maybe a little bit better for the role of Lex Luthor. And I think the interesting thing also moving forward with this is, are we going to hear more casting announcements soon, especially with the approachment of the Screen Actors Guild strike upon us, specifically since as of this recording, which is on Friday, June 30th, at midnight on July 1st, that is when the contract is up and a potential strike could be involved, which would really vehemently shut down all of Hollywood, even productions that are trying to go on right now. You can't do anything without your actors, and that would also involve kind of casting and anything else you want to do with any actor members. And a part of the reports for this, and the reason that I think this decision was not per se rushed, but it was really kind of fast-tracked, shorter than I think a lot of people probably realized that this would actually maybe go on for a couple of months, but it was really a matter of weeks after the test came about on Father's Day weekend. And I think a part of that is because of the audition contracts were up for these actors, and the Screen Actors Guild could potentially go on strike soon, that they wanted to make sure they at least locked down their two main leads in Cornenswet and Brosnan. And I'm wondering, now that those are filled out, do they try to fast track some of these more actors or roles that they want to fill out? Because they still have to do Pa and Ma Kent, they still have to do Lex Luthor, they still have to do Perry White. Jimmy Olsen, I think, is another one that is going to have a role in this, and that was one of the other additional castings that they put out there as kind of secondary co-supporting characters like Lex Luthor. Jimmy Olsen was on that list, so I'm thinking that Jimmy Olsen is going to have a big role. Not a big role, but a good substantial role to play in Superman Legacy, and so I think that is going to be very interesting to see. But overall, I think James Gunn, Peter Safran, the execs made the right two decisions in greenlighting both David Cornenswet and Rachel Brosnahan for those two roles. I'm really excited to see what they do, and I'm really excited to see this movie when it comes out on July of 2025. What do you guys think about the news that the new Superman and new Lois Lane have been found, and David Cornenswet and Rachel Brosnahan? Do you like the names? Do you like the fits? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. Now to move on to some other news that is going on around the world of Hollywood. I want to get into some trending trailers that have happened over the last couple of days. And the first one that I want to talk about is for a brand new Blumhouse film that is set to come out in October of this year. And that is the live action film debut of the video game hit Friday Night at Freddy's, which stars Josh Hutcherson and is, again, based off of the hit video game series. And looking at the trailer for this one, I really enjoyed what I saw. I think it was a really interesting kind of blend of horror and comedy, kind of what Blumhouse can do with these kinds of movies. And seeing Josh Hutcherson back in the film world, which I feel like I haven't seen him do any films really since the Hunger Games series ended back in 2015. So to see him in a film like this is really cool and exciting. The premise seems interesting. It seems like it's going to be a legit horror film. And for a studio like Blumhouse, this is their bread and butter. And I think that this film could have success. The only thing that concerns me about it, and they did the same thing with the last two Halloween films, and those films didn't really come out the best as you would hope. And the reason I think you could see the warning signs for that was the fact that those films came out on a day and date release with both theaters and on Peacock, which again, Blumhouse has a partnership with Universal. Universal is the owner of Peacock, and so when you look at those last two Halloween films and how they really kind of played out, it gives you, I think, a little less confidence maybe in this film of how good is it actually, in the fact that Universal has decided to put this day and date release both in theaters and on a streaming service. I feel like if they had confidence in this film, they would just put it out in theaters. I know this is a formula that they've been playing around with a little bit, and to me, it just doesn't really work out. I think it needs to play in theaters before going to a streaming service, and I feel like you've seen that format really kind of come back where it goes on streaming. If it does have a certain level of success, it plays in theaters a lot longer before going to the first kind of pay window, then second pay window, both on streaming and then video on demand. So that to me is the more concerning part about this, but just looking at the trailer alone by itself, I really enjoyed it. It's coming out on October 27th, and I think it could have success given the fact that you are playing around the Halloween time. But again, that day and date release always gives me cause to pause, especially now that we're coming out of the pandemic right now and more studios are putting their films out for release before putting them on their streaming service. But the other trailer that came up this week that got me super excited, and I cannot wait for November 3rd, is of course the latest trailer for Dune Part 2, which was actually surprising because usually with a film like this, and I remember when the first trailer came out a few months ago, Warner Brothers made a big kind of marketing push for that trailer where they had a trailer before the trailer, kind of making an announcement that the trailer was dropping a day later. And for this one, they just dropped this trailer right at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time yesterday morning. And I gotta say, it looks just as phenomenal as the last trailer that played a couple of months ago. And I cannot wait to see this trailer, like the first one, on the biggest screen possible, because it looks amazing. I mean, there's no other words to really describe how great this film looks. The first film, the first part really of Dune, when it came out in 2021, was amazing. And you knew that with Denis Villeneuve back at the helm as director, with everyone really kind of coming back, and with the new additions to the cast alongside Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya, new additions like Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, Christopher Walken as the Emperor, who we finally get a first look at in this trailer, you knew they were going to deliver and just feel confident that, okay, the first part did really well. We now know what audience is like. We can just kind of finish up this story of this novel in the best way possible. And it just looks epic and engrossing. The characters are amazing. I think you can tell, especially the confidence in people that were in the first part, like Timmy and Zendaya and Rebecca Ferguson and Javier Bardem. You just can feel the confidence they have in these characters now that they're back again, and it just looks amazing. The characters are great, the action looks incredible, and I'm hoping this film just does really, really, really well, because now the fact that the first film made $400 million during an era of the COVID during 2021, it's not going to have that this year. And the fact that film made $400 million worldwide with those restrictions, how much is this one going to do? Can it make $600, $700, $800 million, doubling what the first film was able to put in? It's going to be very interesting to see, and I know it's going to be more of a crowded November, but I think this part has a lot going for it. I think it has marquee names. I think Zendaya is a huge name out there right now that will drive people. I think Timothy Chalamet isn't on that level. I know people want him to be, but we'll see if this is another film that can draw people out because of those two stars, and the rest of the cast is A-list as well. I think Austin Butler could be another name that drives people to the seats coming off of the success of Elvis. This is going to be his first major film since that one premiered, and since he was became an Oscar nominated actor. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this all kind of plays itself out. But it looks great. The cinematography from Craig Frazier is just chef's kiss. It just looked great. I mean, the location, you can tell they shot on location. The VFX look amazing. I mean, I don't really know what else to say about it other than, yeah, it just looks phenomenal. Give me the movie now. I don't even come out on November 3rd. Come out during August, really. Just put this film out right now. So I'm very excited to see this film. Cannot wait for it. It's one of my most anticipated films of the year, and this just keeps on solidifying it with these trailers. So can't wait to see this trailer in theaters. Can't wait to see this film on the biggest screens possible. And I'm going to be seeing this one, I think, multiple times, and it looks just great. So, yep, Dune Part 2, November 3rd. Check out the trailer. It looks amazing, and make sure to get ready for it on November 3rd of this year. Speaking of Warner Brothers and movies coming out, I want to get into one of the last big kind of news topics on the podcast today, and that has to do with, again, what I called at the top of the show and what I've been saying on this podcast for many, many months, is for me, the box office matchup of the year, possibly the box office matchup of the decade, and probably, again, over-exaggerating probably a lot in calling it the box office matchup of the century. And that is, of course, the title matchup of original films, but great auteur directors going at it in Barbie versus Oppenheimer. Barbie directed and co-written with Greta Gerwig alongside Noah Baumbach, who is her partner, and having an A-list cast that includes Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, Issa Rae, America Ferrera, Kate McKinnon, Simu Liu, Ken Bingsley Adir, Will Ferrell, and is, of course, based off of the huge iconic property that is Barbie, going up against a auteur director who is one of the best, if not in my opinion, the best in the industry, and Christopher Nolan, who is moving over away from the studio that is bringing Barbie and Warner Brothers, moving from his longtime studio home from WB over to a brand new home in Universal that is distributing Oppenheimer for everyone to see. And that alone has also an incredible A-list cast that includes Cillian Murphy, Robert Downey Jr., Matt Damon, Florence Pugh, Emily Blunt, one of the Safdie brothers, Jack McQuaid, Josh Peck, just an impeccable cast alongside of it to go with Christopher Nolan as well. So the big kind of question about it, about this weekend, is which director is going to come out on top, which film is going to come out on top, and which studio is going to come out on top that weekend. And when you look at the initial tracking right now, I think this is going to come to a surprise for a lot of people, in that it seems like right now Barbie is tracking ahead of Oppenheimer. And I think if you were to say that at the beginning of this year, I think a lot of other people would have said you are crazy for even thinking that. Because when you think of Christopher Nolan, he is one of those rare breeds of a director and an artist that people will go to a film of his based on his name alone. If you say a film done by Christopher Nolan, that is going to get people excited to go see this film, no matter what it is. And a lot of his films other than really the Dark Knight trilogy, are original films that were co-written or written and directed by himself, and he just delivers on a cinematic experience. So he is one of those rare kind of breeds, like a kind of a Quentin Tarantino, like a Jordan Peele nowadays, that is able to bring butts in seats because of his name alone. Very rarely happens for a director. It used to happen a lot for actors, but for a director to be the main star of a film, it's a very rare breed nowadays, especially, and he is one of the rare types that can bring in box office just on his name alone. And you would have thought that because of that, that film would have easily topped the box office, at least for opening weekend. But instead, the reverse is happening right now, where Oppenheimer's opening up potentially around $40 million, and Barbie is tracking for $70 to $80 million as opening weekend. And the very interesting thing about Barbie is that that film, for a film that, again, has an A-list cast, a great award-worthy director in Greta Gerwig, a big backing from a major studio, that really this is their primary summer film alongside with The Flash, which is kind of a little bit of a flop right now. This is really what Warner Brothers is going to be directing everything towards right now. And the thing about it is it has absolutely no premium level format screens. IMAX going to Oppenheimer for three straight weekends, which makes sense because Nolan is basically the poster child for IMAX. He delivers everything in IMAX. He innovates with the IMAX camera, so it made sense that IMAX would exclusively make sure that all their screens were for Nolan. And Universal made sure to ink that deal a couple of years ago in 2021 when this film was originally greenlit. So that was all taken care of. Then also on top of it, you have a film that is coming out a week before, a little known film called Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, with a little known actor in it called Tom Cruise, who is going to be having all the premium level format screens for about 10 days or so when that movie premieres in theaters across the world on July 12th. And so while Mission Impossible is going to have to give up the IMAX screens for Nolan starting on July 21st, I believe from what I know that at least for the kind of the Dolby screening, some of the other premium level format screens that are out there minus IMAX, those are still going to be involved with Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. So Barbie is really going to kind of be stuck in no man's land in terms of not having those upcharges and ticket prices and kind of advertising people to go see this on the biggest screen possible. And I think people would do that for Barbie, whether it's on IMAX or Dolby, whatever. But the fact that they have none of that and they're leading the initial tracking coming in at between $70 to $80 million is very, very impressive. And the fact that Oppenheimer is only tracking right now at $40 million is not concerning, but I think it shows that the pendulum is swung, I think, in terms of buzz right now. I think Oppenheimer, it has all the ingredients that you would want in a big hit, but they just really haven't been marketing a lot, I feel like. And they've been marketing here and there, but I just think that the power of the marketing for Barbie right now, Universal just can't compete with it because that's not the kind of tone that film is going for. And Barbie is able to be kind of this poppy, lovey summer event, really, that you can kind of market for all ages and all people, really, I feel like. And Oppenheimer's just not able to compete with that right now. So I think the buzz around Barbie right now is very big and bigger than Oppenheimer at this point in time. But again, these two films are still about a little less than a month or so out, so there's still a couple weeks to see where everything can kind of swing itself towards. Maybe some of the buzz from Barbie dies down, maybe it picks back up again, especially once Oppenheimer and Barbie start screening their films and you hear some of that positive, those reactions come out, the word of mouth, that could help swing one or another and change the tide. But some of the questions that I had actually in regards to these is, when it comes to these two films specifically, because again, it's two films that, even though Barbie is based off of an iconic doll, an iconic toy set, it's really kind of not an original idea, but Greta Gerwig, Noah Baumbach are original screenwriters, and they're coming in kind of trying to shake up the Barbie world a little bit and deliver their own style and their own spin on the idea, really. And so it's really a creative, visionary film, really, even though it's based off of an IP for the most part in Barbie. And then you have a completely original idea from Christopher Nolan. And so for these films, is it about opening big on opening weekend, or is it about the legs that these films need to have? So even though Barbie could very well open theoretically opening weekend do maybe even exceeds expectations of word of mouth is great for the film, which I hope it is, and it exceeds $70 to $80 million opening weekend and actually opens maybe to 90 to 100, maybe even 100 million plus opening weekend. Does that mean that the legs for this film and on Oppenheimer matter more than opening weekend? So if Barbie does outperform things on opening weekend, and maybe even Oppenheimer opens above 40 million, maybe does 50, 60, 70 million dollars maybe, and you look at that and you're like, oh man, Oppenheimer opened really low, especially with IMAX screenings. Barbie, as of right now, doesn't really have that. What does that mean moving forward? But I think if you look at what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks after opening weekend is really where the story is going to become telling for this, for these two films. Because if Barbie opens strong, but then maybe fizzles out a little bit once you kind of see this film, the curiosity fades away, will it have multiple repeat viewings? Or will something like Oppenheimer, where you want to go see it on the best screen possible, Nolan makes his films for the theatrical experience, and those IMAX IMAX 70 millimeter screenings are only available a few times a day, does that mean that the percentage of decrease in the film's box office weekend is going to be a lot smaller than maybe Barbie's might be, and that could sustain Oppenheimer more so than Barbie, and maybe the overall grosses of these two films will outweigh themselves, and that maybe Oppenheimer might start off slow and Barbie starts off high, but at the end Oppenheimer wins out and Barbie is a little bit under what Oppenheimer does. So those, I think, are the big questions for Barbie and Oppenheimer in terms of this matchup. I think it's more about the long-term game than it is about the short-term. It's not about what you do in the very beginning. And that says for a lot of these films, I think that is what it's really going to kind of come down to. And when you look at the success of some of these films, especially during the summer season, where it's really just been one blockbuster after another, especially during the month of June, basically every single weekend has kind of been a blockbuster or a big movie with a big kind of a star. So you look at some of these films and you see that without a sustained level of premium level screens, can some of these films have success? And I think recent evidence of this is kind of mixed a little bit. And I think when you see some of the films that have had success and some of the films that don't, it just showcases what audiences are into right now. So the films that have really kind of had success during this summer movie season, you look at a film like Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Across the Spider-Verse. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 had premium level screens like IMAX, 3D, Dolby for 2 weekends, and then they lost them. But Guardians of the Galaxy was, I think, a big enough success and had great word of mouth alone, and the IP was very valuable. People love those characters. It was able to have great success over the run and still have sustainable legs even after losing those screens. And same thing with Spider-Verse, where it opened up huge, had $120 or so million opening weekend, had those premium level format screens, but then lost them the following week to Transformers Rise of the Beast. But still, because of the positive word of mouth, people wanted to see the film. The hype was legitimate for that movie. People still saw that film IMAX or Dolby, or no IMAX or Dolby, really. But when you look at some of the films that have not had success, you look at Transformers Rise of the Beast, had a respectable opening weekend on June 9th, made around $60 or so million, which, again, isn't what the Michael Bay films used to do, but better than the last two films that came out in both Bumblebee and Transformers of the Last Night. Then the weekend after is when you had The Flash come out, and that was the second weekend for Transformers Rise of the Beast. For the second weekend for Transformers, losing all those screens, the plummeting and the drop for its second weekend for that film was dramatic. Dropped basically around 65-69% from opening weekend to sophomore weekend, which is not what that film needed to do. Same thing with a film like Fast 10, where the premium level screens for that film, it did respectable for its opening weekend, but then it didn't have a huge drop off like Transformers or even The Flash, but it still had a drop off in its weekend to weekend. And I think because of those not having those premium level screens, because it went from Fast 10 to the next weekend, which was Memorial Day weekend, was when Disney's live action retelling of The Little Mermaid came out, and that film only had success. I mean, it's had sustained success here domestically, but it could have done, I think, better if it had a couple of weekends of runway in having these premium level screening. So I think it's a mixed bag of not having premium level screenings. And I think for Barbie, while it might open big because of the curiosity, is this a film that will have sustained success and put up big dollars without those revenues? Because sure, you can start off, you can not start off big, but if you don't have those ticket prices to really kind of surcharge on those experiences because you don't have those big premium screenings, is that really going to benefit a film? Or is something like Oppenheimer, where maybe again starts off small, but a lot of the screenings that do happen for it is because of those IMAX level charges that they have, and that's what drives the opening weekend? If so, then that film still has the opening weekend charges. It still has those premium level screenings for another 2 weeks. And if the film is as great as people think it's going to be, the word of mouth for that film is only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So you're going to have people that want to go see the film, premium level or no premium level screening, and you're going to want to have people that make sure they go to the film to see it on the biggest screen possible. So kind of like Avatar 2 in a way, people will wait to see it on the biggest screen possible, which is why those films have the success that they've had and have made billions and billions of dollars at the box office. And I'm not saying Oppenheimer is going to do that, but the strategy is kind of the same, where people are going to want to go see a film on the biggest, best screen possible. People say you have to see it in this kind of a way. So the fact that Oppenheimer has IMAX for those three straight weekends, and Barbie, while again, the buzz might be there, but it might not be strong over the next couple of weeks once those initial waves of curiosity die down, that's really where the interest is going to come into, is the long term, I think, for this film, and not the short term game. So there's a lot of moving parts and dynamics to this kind of matchup for Barbie versus Oppenheimer, and it's going to be great to see how it unfolds over these next couple of weeks. And even after these films open up, I think the box office run for these films is going to be very interesting to follow throughout the rest of the summer movie season. So what do you guys think about this kind of opening prognostication for Barbie versus Oppenheimer? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And the final thing that I want to discuss on the podcast today is going into the weekend preview for this weekend, which is the last weekend for June and the beginning opening days of July, which of course this weekend is actually July 4th weekend as well. So we have a couple of films that are going to be coming out to close out June and open up the month of July. And the big one, of course, this weekend is Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, directed by James Mangold, who has done incredible films such as Logan, 310 to Yuma, and Ford vs. Ferrari, takes over the directing reins from the great Steven Spielberg on this one, and it sees a return of the Whiplasher himself in the one and only Harrison Ford, back for one last ride in the fedora as Indiana Jones, and he brings alongside an amazing supporting cast that includes Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Mads Mikkelsen, Antonio Banderas, and so many more, alongside Boyd Holbrook, who is also somebody who has been alongside a lot of James Mangold films. And this is a film that I'm really looking forward to. It's amazing to kind of see the trajectory of this film over the last month or so. It debuted at the Cannes Film Festival, kind of came out with mixed reviews, but ever since then, people who have seen this film have actually come to enjoy it, and I'm really excited to see this film. I don't hate Kingdom of the Crystal Skull as a lot of people do. It's not obviously the best Indiana Jones film, doesn't come close to those three original films back in the 80s, but it's still an okay movie, but I'm very excited to see a kind of return to form for Indiana Jones. And I'm not expecting this to match up to those three films, but I'm hoping it to have a great, amazing one last adventure with an iconic character like Indiana Jones, with Harrison Ford in that role for one last time. So I really enjoy the trailers that have come out so far. I've been looking forward to this one, and I'm excited to see it. So if you're definitely looking to something new to see this weekend, this could be one to check out. And for the families out there that have already seen Super Mario Brothers and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse and even Elemental, there's a brand new animated film coming out this summer, or this weekend rather, in DreamWorks' new animated feature, Ruby Gilman Teenage Kraken is the name of the film. And I've seen the trailers for this one. It looks fun and enjoyable. I don't think the box office for this one is all that great, but we'll see where it all lands. But those are the two films that I would recommend this weekend, of course, and the ones to check out, of course, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny and Ruby Gilman Teenage Kraken. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Sam Bassell Podcast. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out my channel for more content. You can check me out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, SoundCloud, and much more. Also, make sure to tune in on to the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions, and be sure to check out the other amazing shows that are on here, such as You Mad Bro, the number one source to see what the internet is pissed off about on a weekly basis. Also, make sure to check out Goal Driven Professionals, geared toward improving client relations, return on investment, and customer acquisition costs for independent businesses and services. Also, make sure to check out The Daily Grind, a weekly motivational podcast with Callie Johnson, giving you everyday tips and key takeaways on reaching your goals. Also, along the way, make sure to check out these other amazing shows on the Podcast Solutions, such as Wrestle Addict Radio, Fretzelmania Podcast, and Midnight Showing. You can check these out and so much more on the website, ambiguouspodcastsolutions.com, also on Facebook and Twitter at Real Ambiguous, and at Real Ambiguous. And if you want to check out Canopy Treehouse, use the coupon code AMBIGUOUS. Also, when you get a chance, make sure to follow me on social media. You can find me on Twitter at Bassell Samuel, that's BUSSELLSAMUEL, and also on Facebook at Sam Bassell. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in, and until next time, keep on screening.